The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Kennedy, Hugh Hewitt, live in Studio North. Good June 6th to you. The 79th anniversary of the Allies invasion led by Dwight Eisenhower and the American forces, British forces, Canadian forces across the English Channel to liberate Nazi-occupied Germany. And to anyone who was alive at that time and participated in the invasion or supported it, thank you. You know, Joe Biden was alive for D-Day. How many people do you know who were alive for D-Day? President Biden was. He wasn't quite two. President Trump was not. But when you begin to consider the president's age, begin to think, how many people do I know that actually were alive for D-Day? Well, there's other D-Days going on. Lots of activity in Ukraine this morning. Ukraine live briefing. Ukrainian forces claim advances along the front line. Russia says it repelled an attack in Donetsk. The New York Times reports that the U.S. officials see signs of a counteroffensive unfolding in Ukraine. In the Telegraph of Great Britain, how Ukraine's activity is aimed at shaping the battlefield to its own advantage. They're just screwing around, right? They're just probing everywhere to make sure that the Russians have no idea what they're going. So what did the Russians do? They blew up a dam. The Novokakhovka Dam destroyed, and flooding is occurring in dozens of places throughout Ukraine. Russia says Ukraine did it. That's silly. Ukraine is not blowing up its own dams. Russia did it, and that's who we're up against. And more power to the Ukrainians, more weapons to the Ukrainians, more aid to the Ukrainians. I'm 100% with that. Let me go to the domestic stories. Lawyers for former President Trump visited the Justice Department yesterday as leak after leak after leak says that classified document inquiry is nearing its end. Do you know what's going on here? I want you to understand what's going on here. Trump lawyers asked Justice Department not to charge Trump in classified documents case, according to the Washington Post. You do know what's going on here, right? Jack Smith is busy trying to lobby Merrick Garland not to block the indictment. All these leaks of this person going in. Now, CBS News caught the lawyers going in, but everything else about that is a leak. Prosecutors are talking to the media because they got to get past Merrick Garland. I think it's a disaster to indict the former president on having documents like every other president ends up with documents. I think it's an absolute fiasco if they do that. Of course, I don't think he's responsible for January 6th. The Alvin Bragg bump is wearing down as Ron DeSantis begins to surge in some polls again. President Trump got a bump from Alvin Bragg's absurd indictment in New York, but that led to a partisan rallying around the former president. Now that's beginning to dissipate. The U.S. House panel is going to pursue contempt of Congress proceedings against FBI Director Christopher Wray. Now, I don't know Director Wray. A lot of my friends are mutual friends with him, and they speak very highly of him. But there is no constitutional argument for not turning over a subpoenaed document from the FBI to the Congress. None. I know there are lots of policy arguments out there. Oh, my, well, you know, it's no good. I don't even care if it's a kid's drawing, if it's a Genghis Khan drawing of Baba. I don't really care. It can be anything. It can be, you know, a page from the phone book. I don't really care what it is. I don't really care what they say it might do. All I know is that the Congress has the authority to conduct oversight of the executive branch pursuant to the United States Constitution. If they say, give us a document, and they subpoena it, you don't get to say no. It's like you don't get to say no to a grand jury summons. You don't get to say no to a subpoena, Dukas Tecum, or anything else. You don't get to say no. And I do not understand why Director Wray isn't already in contempt of Congress. I don't understand it. Chris Sununu, governor of New Hampshire, made his announcement yesterday. Cut number five from CNN.
You and governor, thank you so much for inviting us here to the Granite State.
Absolutely.
Your decision. Yeah, so we've taken the last 6 months to really kind of look at things, where everything is, and I've made the decision not to run for president on the Republican ticket in 2024. Obviously, a lot goes into that decision, but it's been quite an adventure, but not the end of the adventure by any means.
Chris Sununu is out. Mike Pence is formally in as of yesterday. I think the former vice president will be joining me on Friday. Cornel West, Princeton scholar and leftist, has announced a third-party bid for president. That gives heartburn to our friends over on the left. Tim Scott did a marvelous job on The View yesterday. Let's go to the major exchange with Sonny Hostin. By the way, I don't know anything about Sonny Hostin. I've never watched The View except via clips that Dwayne provides me because Dwayne watches The View. Dwayne and Carl, Carl, our house painter friend who's retired to Texas, and Dwayne actually watch The View together most days when they talk about how Dwayne is staying on his diet. By the way, myphdweightloss.com, great sponsor of the show. MyPhDweightLoss.com, 864-644-1900. Dwayne, did you get to watch The View with Carl yesterday?
See, I know that's a- see, Carl's a retired guy, so he watches it during the day because that's what retired people do. I'm normally sleeping at the time The View's on, so Carl gets
so
to watch it live.
And then he
tells me later what I need to go back and
by
watch.
By the way, did you get a picture of the Brian the Banker Red Sox hat?
I have it. It's on my phone.
You don't have it ready to put up on the screen. If I had a producer, I would show you my baseball Boston Red Sox cap because Brian the Banker has offered to raffle this hat off to the large, and we'll match the largest donation.
I thought the goal was to actually raise money and send kids to camp, not actually go the other direction and cost kids a chance.
No, no one can take their donations back because of the
I think there's a legal statute they can if there's a Red Sox hat involved.
So I want to go back to my PhD weight loss, and I'll come back to Brian the Banker and the Red Sox hat, Angel Tree.
864-644-1900. That's 864-644-1900.
Don't binge eat while watching The View today. Anyway, Tim Scott on The View yesterday with Sonny Hostin. Cut number one, the key exchange.
One of the things I think about, and one of the reasons why I'm on the show, is because of the comments that were made, frankly, on this show, that the only way for a young African-American kid to be successful in this country is to be the exception and not the rule. That is a dangerous, offensive, disgusting message to send to our young people today, that the only way to succeed is by being the exception. I will tell you that if my life is the exception, I can't imagine. But it's not, actually.
It's been 114 years.
Yeah, so the fact of the matter is we've had an African-American president, African-American vice president. We've had two African-Americans to be secretaries of the state. In my home city, the police chief is an African-American who's now running for mayor. The head of the highway patrol for South Carolina is an African-American. In 1975, there was about 15% employment in the African-American community for the first time in the history of the country. It's under 5%.
40% homelessness.
And 50% of the folks in our community.
13% of the population.
You had a chance to ask the question. I know that I've watched you on the show that you like people to be deferential and respectful, so I'm going to do the same thing.
That is true.
So here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest the fact of the matter is that progress in America is palpable. It can be measured in generations. I look back at the fact that my grandfather, born in 1921 in Sally, South Carolina, when he was on a sidewalk, a white person was coming, he had to step off and not make eye contact. That man believed then, with some doubt now, in the goodness of America, because he believed that having faith in God, faith in himself, and faith in what the future could hold for his kids would unleash opportunities in ways that you cannot imagine. Every kid today can look, just change the stations and see how much progress has been made in this country. ABC, NBC, CBS, ESPN, CNN, Fox News all have African-American and Hispanic hosts. So what I'm suggesting is that the yesterday's exception is today's rule. And for us to
suggest America has met its promise.
No, of course, the concept of America is that we are going to become a more perfect union. But in fact, the challenges that we face 50 years ago and 60 years ago should not be the same challenges that we face today. And here's a way that you measure that. When my mother was born, about 10% of African Americans got a high school degree, diploma. Today is over 90%. When you look at the income success
that's
we've had.
HBCU stat.
Well, listen, HBCUs is a good one, because one of the reasons why I took the funding for HBCUs to the highest level in the history of the country, and then I helped make it permanent, is because I believe that education is the closest thing to magic in America. So I'm about making sure that our kids have as many opportunities to succeed as possible. It's one of the reasons why
I need an opportunity to succeed because I have to go to Brandon. Tim Scott is a master of this, and it was just fabulous. Way to go, Senator Scott. I'm coming right back. I got lots more news. I've got lots of guests today. We've got Captain Jerry Hendricks coming up to talk about the shouldering incident that was narrowly averted on the high seas in the South China Sea and international waterways. We've got Byron York, Representative Ken Calvert. We got Bethany Mandel, Molly Hemingway, Jason Chaffetz coming by, Brett Baer coming by. A lot of big things going on today on this edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Don't go anywhere. Happy D-Day, all of you D-Day survivors. Joe Biden wasn't at D-Day. He was just alive for D-Day. That's how old he is. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Good D-Day, America. It's appropriate that we have a naval story today, as D-Day represented the greatest single amphibious assault in history. I keep in my three studios this book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, by Captain Jerry Hendricks, forward by John Lehman. Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. And I keep it because Jerry Hendricks is one of the country's leading navalists. If you read The Atlantic, you read his article on it. Good morning, Captain Hendricks. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm up and about.
That's good. We're making progress. How astonishing was the D-Day naval lift?
Oh, I mean, it's a near miraculous, if you really think about it, because everyone thinks about June 6th. But no one really understands that June 6th was just day one of a 30-day process. And so, you know, we began on June 6th. We had ships going back and forth between the United Kingdom and France for the next 30 days. We had to keep the sea lanes open. We had to keep the logistics coming. The only way to get that number of troops ashore and hold them was a massive ASW, anti-submarine warfare, anti-mining logistics lift. It was one of the most intricate naval maneuvers processes in the history of the world. And I think Eisenhower rightly believed that that was his most significant achievement in his life. Not even the presidency surmounted what he accomplished with Normandy and D-Day.
Well, you were the first one to ever tell me he was buried in his uniform because of his belief that he would be remembered for Operation Overlord as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, that's correct. It's kind of interesting. If you look at Eisenhower's funeral, his five-star General of the Army flag actually precedes his presidential flag, and he died on active duty. He requested that John F. Kennedy return him to active duty as a five-star general of the armies after he left the presidency, because when he passed, he knew that in 500 years, he always talked about the 500-year test, in 500 years, he would be remembered as the victor in Normandy, not as a two-term president of the United States, and I think he's correct.
Now, Jerry, let's turn to the subject on which you've been helping me. From the Financial Times this morning, U.S. prepared to address aggressiveness of Chinese military. Yesterday, we played the video, I hope we still have it, of the incident in the Taiwan Strait. And I called up Jerry yesterday. He's my go-to guy in all things Navy. And I said, Jerry, who was watching? What was going on? Will you take listeners, Jerry Hendricks, into what was going on as the American, I think it was a guided missile frigate, right, approached the China transit of the Taiwan Strait. Maybe it wasn't a frigate. Tell me everything I need to know.
Okay, so an Arleigh Burke class destroyer, a guided missile destroyer, the USS Chung Hoon, DDG 93, one of our big 9,500 ton destroyers, was doing a transit through the Strait of Taiwan. Now, the Strait of Taiwan is international waters. That is free international waters. And a Luoyang 3 frigate of the Chinese Navy, 6,300 tons, comes alongside the port side, the left side of the Chung Hoon, and then crosses 150 yards just in front of her in this maneuver that we can see here if you're watching on YouTube. By the way, Chung Hoon was operating in conjunction with a Canadian ally, so there was a Canadian frigate right behind Chung Hoon. So this was an international exercise in international waters to demonstrate that it was the high seas. It is international waters. And this is something that we do quite frequently. So very unsafe maneuver, passing within 150 yards. In fact, an unprofessional maneuver. And this is something that ship drivers look at. Not only is this unsafe, it's unprofessional. And it sort of demonstrates a lack of proficiency, a lack of training on the part of the Chinese.
So you have talked to me for years about the possibility of a, quote, shouldering incident, close quote. Would you explain what that is? And then also, in the context of this weekend's incident, do you think Lloyd Austin was watching in real time the head of PACOM? What was going on back at the White House Situation Room as we approach near miss with a Chinese naval vessel?
Well, Hugh, you know, these Taiwan Transit Strait procedures, these maneuvers we do these repeatedly. We do these, you know, anywhere between 4 to 6 times a year just to demonstrate that we consider those waters to be international. But we know that when it happens, it's going to excite the Chinese. They do not want us there. They believe that those are their internal waters. Obviously, they claim Taiwan, so they believe the strait between the two. So I have no doubt that, for instance, Admiral Aquilino, the commander of Indo-PACOM, was watching this in real-time video coming off the ship because it's just that level. And I'm sure that the teletype going between Indo-PACOM and then the Situation Room in the White House was probably alive with each moment of how things were going, because these things are monitored that way. Note that this is, you know, we do these repeatedly. This is not even the most unsafe the Chinese have been. In fact, in 2018, they cut off the USS Decatur. They came within 43 yards of her and caused her to go all back with that. I think that's actually one of the reasons why it's kind of interesting. We use the ship Chung Hoon is one of the two ships that is sunk in Jim Stavridis's 2034 novel that begins the World War III scenario there. So this is something that we see happening repeatedly. And by the way, the Chinese have a real a fear of this particular ship. It's named after our first Asian-American admiral, Gordon Chung Hoon, who was a graduate of the Naval Academy prior to World War II and commanded the destroyer Sigsbee in the war. And he won the Navy Cross and the Silver Star. The Chinese think that we actually used the USS Chung Hoon to deliberately embarrass them in the region, highlighting the great service of Asian Americans in our Navy. So they really sort of get really sensitized when Chung Hoon shows up, because they think that we're sort of deliberately poking him in the eye. So, but anyways, these processes and procedures are normal. What we've seen is them becoming increasingly aggressive. And in fact, I've noted that they've designed a new ship, the Type 55 Cruiser, which is 11,500 tons. She's bigger than our destroyers. She has a long, what I call a slab side, a flat side. I believe that ship has been designed specifically to be able to come out and shoulder us, where we actually make contact between the two ships and they use their greater mass to shove us out of the way. This is something that the Soviets did on a couple of occasions during the Cold War, 1988 in particular, in the Black Sea. They actually came out, made contact with one of our Spruance class destroyers at the time and tried to move it out of the waters that they were claiming there in the Black Sea. So I believe that this incident is coming, that we will have a shouldering situation. And if they don't handle it professionally, if they can't drive their ships well, then in fact, that could be a collision that could result in the loss of life. None of us want to see that level of unprofessionalism resulting in that type of a disaster.
Captain Hendricks, had there been contact, what would have been the result in your professional estimate?
Well, given the angle of the approach there, and mind you, 150 yards, you know, we weren't there and we had slowed. So I know that they took our ship, reduced her speed down to maintain separation. But had they come in and deliberately tried to make contact with that type of angle, you could have seen a puncturing of the hulls of both ships, letting seawater in, resulting in loss of life, damage to machinery. That is what none of us want to see. And in fact, we've had some incidents in the past where there's been, you know, impacts between ships where we've lost like the entire bow section of a cruiser way back during the Cold War. And so you don't want to see these things. You want to see professionalism. But the Chinese are reacting in a very emotional way. And you saw this with the speech given by their defense minister, where he calls these operations, which are normal operations in international waters, he's calling them deliberately provocative and escalatory. And he's doing that in the presence of Lloyd Austin at a defense conference overseas. So it's very clear they want us to back off. And the fact that they won't sit down and meet with our Secretary of Defense shows that they believe that they don't have to under the situation. And that disturbs me a lot, that they're beginning to view us as the supplicant and them as the suzerain in this, or the senior power in the region. And we've allowed that to happen because we've allowed our Navy to shrink in size and our presence to be reduced.
Now, Captain Hendricks, for those who are just turning in, I'm talking with Captain Jerry Hendricks, author of To Bribe Biden, Maintain, as well as the key piece in The Atlantic this summer on building the American Navy. I went to a Blue Bubble seminar at my reunion. Three China experts. It's Chatham House rules. I can't quote anyone. But the assertion was made in the conversation that we are being provocative when we send aircraft carriers along the coast of China. What would we do if a Chinese aircraft carrier came along the American coast? My answer would be, well, if they're outside of internet, if they're outside of domestic waters, nothing, absolutely nothing. Am I right?
Well, I mean, we would come out and monitor their operations as they come out and monitor our operations. We do a large exercise in the Pacific every year. Last year, 23 nations came. China sends their intelligence gathering assets to come out and monitor that operation to try and learn from us. If they come to American shores and operate in international waters, but off our coast, we'll come out and watch what they do, but they are free to do that. That's been part of our tradition and process all along, is that international waters is international waters, and we want to uphold that. So, no, I don't think that we would respond aggressively. We would monitor them and put a ship in tail or trail behind them, but no, that wouldn't be escalatory. But the idea that somehow us continuing to operate in the same waters that we've operated in consistently since the end of World War II is escalatory, is counter to the use of that word. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, that is not by definition escalatory. You need to change the condition in the environment for there to be an escalation or de-escalation. So that makes no sense to me. And by the way,
I almost believe that any panel without a naval officer on it who served in those waters, and it's just simply not a good panel. Captain Hendricks, I want to close by saying, could that have escalated out of control? That incident that we saw, could that have escalated to the point of conflict beyond the ships?
I don't know if it would escalate it to war. I think it could have escalated to damage to both of the navies and loss of life with both of them. That would have been an international incident that would have been gone to a negotiating table, and we would have, you know, protested. The only thing that I think really escalates that leads to war is if someone trains their gun and fires one. And I don't think that was going to happen on either side at this point in time. But I do believe that we are on a slow march towards that type of a moment, because they are becoming increasingly emotional, unprofessional, and desperate in their actions, because they feel that they're losing face within the region and from the other powers of the region, like the Japanese, like the Taiwanese, now like the Philippines, which is increasingly trending towards the American side in this competition. And they're watching what we're doing with India and Australia. They're very nervous at this point in time. So I think that they are moving towards a moment of desperation where I cannot predict what they'll do at that moment.
Captain Jerry Hendricks, author of this book, which you can still get, To Provide, Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Always a pleasure to see you, Captain. Thank you for filling in the blanks on this incident this weekend. I'll be right back, America. David Drucker is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. That music means David Drucker's in the house, but he's not in the house. He's in O'Hare Airport. Normally we have him by video on the Salem News Channel, but he's by phone this morning because he's transiting back from Iowa, I believe. Good morning, Drucker. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh.
If we apply the RNC's 40,000 individual contributors at 1% rule, who is going to be on, in your opinion and your guesstimate, the debate stage in August in Milwaukee?
Well, look, I think most of the top-level candidates will get on there, but we'll see. I think Haley will get on. She's been in the race long enough. Ramaswamy says he's passed the threshold already. DeSantis will obviously get on there. Trump will qualify, already has, I'm sure. And then we'll take a look at Mike Pence, Chris Christie, Doug Burgum. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out.
You're forgetting Larry Elder and that's about Asa Hutchinson. I do not think will make it.
I question whether or not Larry Elder will make it. But the people – oh, and Tim Scott, he will make it.
Yes, he'll make
South Carolina.
Yeah. So given that lineup, does that field – shrink quickly, in your view?
Well, listen, it's always about whether or not you can continue to raise enough money to sustain a campaign, number one. And that's something we do not know yet because this race is not developed enough yet in terms of the field of candidates that we believe we now have. Second of all, will some of these candidates say to themselves at some point, if things are middling but not really taking off, I don't want to contribute to dividing up the field such that it guarantees the current front runner, which is Donald Trump, a guaranteed victory. And if that's a concern, then some of these candidates will have something to think about. If it's not a concern at all for whatever reason, then as long as they can raise enough money to get them around New Hampshire or Iowa or both or South Carolina, you know, they'll stay in. That's what it always comes down to.
Now, I'm sure you, like me, are staying in Republican Switzerland or journalist Switzerland where we don't have favorites in this race. I am curious if you think Governor Christie has earned the nickname Kamikaze Chris. Do you think that's why he's in, just to take out Trump?
Well, listen, I've interviewed Chris Christie about this a number of times, and you're right about my Swiss citizenship in this regard. And he's insisted to me every time that running for president is too difficult. It's too big of a task to take on to do it simply to take somebody else out and have no desire to win. And there's nothing glamorous about it that he likes to tell me, you know, when you've stayed in the Holiday Inn Express for the fifth night in a row in a very lovely community, but a community that's not your home, doing it just because you're after one candidate, there's simply not enough motivation to do it that way. What will make his candidacy interesting is from the very beginning, although he's no longer alone in this regard, when you look at how Governor DeSantis is running, how I think Vice President Pence will run. But what you will see from Christie is a willingness to target the front runner and not only second place candidates. When you look at Governor Haley, Ramaswamy, and some others, there's a lot of focus on Ron DeSantis and not so much focus on Donald Trump. And Chris Christie says you become the front runner by contrasting yourself with the front runner. So it'll be interesting to watch that project unfold.
Let's talk a little bit about the debate. I've told people I don't care about the numbers until after the first, actually, two debates. That's when I think the field will begin to gel and we'll figure out where it is. But that second debate, probably at the Ronald Reagan Library, any reporting from you on who's going to host that, when it's going to be?
I don't have reporting as of yet. I hope to have reporting on that soon, if I can dig it up, but nothing yet. But I think you're right about how important these debates are going to be, because it's one thing to go toe-to-toe with candidates when you're not right next to them. It's another thing entirely with the cameras and being right next to them to go toe-to-toe with them. We've seen over the years candidates have plenty of really interesting things to say about why they're better than the other guy. Then they get on stage and it's a different story.
Yeah, the seismic change in politics in the last 12 years is to go from 2012's debates, which were all combative and angry, and 2008's, which were very, very biased, to 2016's, which began to introduce center-right moderators. And I think 2024 is going to be significantly different from 2016. Do you agree?
Well, we'll see. I'm not convinced yet. I mean, it depends on, you know, the hosts and the moderators and what questions they ask. Look, my big gripe with the debates is somebody could be happy to do one. I haven't done one, so I'll just, in case people think it's sour grapes, I don't think you should treat debates like Sunday show interviews, which have their place, and I'm a big fan of. I think what you're trying to do is ask tough questions, but that have to do with issues that Republican primary voters care about. I think it's fine to slip in one or two what I like to call news of the day questions. Just to remind everybody, we're journalists, we're looking for news, but you need to make this about the issues that the voting, the electorate in a particular election are interested in or should be interested in.
This is the point of great agreement between David and I. There are 30 million people who voted in the Republican primaries in 2016. Those 30 million people are the audience for the debates, not MSNBC, not left-wing media anywhere else, not the lefties in any of the newsrooms. They do not matter. Twitter doesn't matter. The 30 million voters in Republican primaries matter. David M. Drucker, chief political correspondent for The Dispatch. Thank you. I'll be right back. America Hour number two. Byron Yorgan joins. Byron Yorgan. Byron York joins me next on the Hugh Hewitt Show. In the meantime, listen to Betsy Wright, Prison Fellowships Director of Angel Tree Camping, tell you why she would love you to join the campaign.
If you're thinking about giving to Angel Tree Camping, your dollars are going to make the difference and they're going to impact a child's life, possibly for their entire future. So please, please give if you can. And I thank you so much for your giving and your willingness to walk beside us in this ministry.
Hundreds and hundreds of you have given. Thank you. I'd love to get hundreds and hundreds more of you, whether it's $10 or $1,000, whether it's $500 to match Brian, or if it's $50 to just give it, or $200 sends one kid additional to camp. Angel Tree Camping makes all the difference in the world for kids who do not have the grandparents who spoil them, the aunts and uncles who take them out. They don't have it. They got mom or dad or both parents in jail. Angel Tree swoops in, picks them up, takes them away for a week, you know, puts them in a relationship with the Angel Tree Prison Fellowship Network, and they prosper. They thrive. You can call in a contribution at 888-206-2764. That's 888-206-2764. Or you can go online at hughhewitt.com. The banner is at the very top. It just has to load. I've even got the Steelers fans learning how to do that, and I appreciate it.
Things where everything is, and I've made the decision not to run for president. On the
morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt in Studio North. That is Governor Chris Sununu of the Granite State bowing out of the 2024 race. I'm joined by Byron York of Fox News and, of course, the Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well.
Do you expect Governor Sununu to have a significant role in guiding Granite State voters towards one or the other candidates?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I think that's the only real effect of his decision not to run, which is in New Hampshire, because if he had run, he would have been a significant factor there, and kind of distorted the race in New Hampshire, and people would discount the results unless he did equally well in Iowa, which I don't think he would have done. So I think basically this removes a potential distortion in New Hampshire.
Well, like his father before him, who endorsed George H.W. Bush when he was governor and became chief of staff in the White House, I believe Governor Sununu may be able to deliver to the state to whomever he endorses. Do you agree with me on that, Byron?
It's entirely possible, although I think back to one of the favorite stories I wrote about the 2016 campaign, which was I flew there from Iowa. It was about a week before the New Hampshire primary. And there was a big Republican gathering, and I talked to just dozens and dozens of people there, and actually had dinner at a table with the current Governor Sununu's father, John Sununu. And I decided to ask everybody a question, which was, do you know anybody who supports Donald Trump? And the answer was always no. And I asked Governor John Sununu the same question, and he and his wife kind of looked at each other and said, finally they said, I think there's somebody down the street who does. And the out-of-touchness was unbelievable. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable because Trump was actually leading. The reason I was asking people was because Trump was leading in the polls at the time and ended up winning a significant victory. So I'm not absolutely sure that that they can direct voters in one way or the other.
It can't hurt a candidate. Let's leave it at that. Byron, I want to test on you my theory. We have a lot of leaks coming out of the Department of Justice about the investigation into President Trump, the latest being the alleged flood that occurred. We have lots of alleged leaks from the Department of Justice. I think what is going on here is that Team Jack Smith, the special prosecutor, is lobbying or putting pressure on Merrick Garland, who must approve or at least not veto their attempt to indict the former president. Now, given Smith's reputation, given that prosecutors like to indict in such a case, it will come down to Garland. Do you view it that way? Because prosecutors leaking this much is very unusual.
Well, I don't always assume that prosecutors are leaking this because when an investigation gets to this point, there's a number of people who know what's going on. Well, let's say this. They know their little piece of what's going on, and they're free to tell reporters. They're not like prosecutors and prohibited from saying things. So and people have all sorts of agendas. So I don't know exactly who is leaking it, but it does appear to be that Smith is getting close to a decision. And the other thing that's absolutely true is that Garland will have to say yes. But remember, I mean, the system okayed an FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, so they could easily okay an indictment.
Now, Axios this morning has two polls showing Governor DeSantis rebounding from his temporary loss of support. I viewed that as rallying around Donald Trump after Alvin Bragg's absurd and ridiculous indictment that still hasn't articulated the underlying felony that they need to resurrect the statute of limitations barred misdemeanors. So Trump got a bump when Alvin Bragg lashed out. Do you think he'll get a bump if Jack Smith indicts him?
Well, I've thought about this. I don't know, but I think certainly with a group of the Republican base, part of the Republican base, the answer is going to be yes. Because when you talk to them, and I was in Iowa Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and if you talk to them, they all believe that Trump has spent years being unfairly targeted by the Justice Department, various investigators, by Democrats, by the media, and they expect this to continue, and it's one of the reasons they support him. So you're right, the Bragg thing, which a lot of people, including me, thought of as a BS indictment.
It's a stunt.
Exactly. It was totally politically motivated.
Yep.
So they dismissed that. Now, will they dismiss a Justice Department indictment, which will be more focused, better crafted, have more evidence? I don't know, but my guess is, yeah, they will.
All right, now let's switch to debates. Ronna McDaniel's on tomorrow. I'll be able to ask her when the second debate's going to be and how high the standards will go. What is your reporting on who, what, where, when? And they'll go from 40,000 contributors and 1% to what, Byron York?
Good question. I have to see how many people end up in the actual first debate. The real question is, can they just have one debate? Do they have to have an adults table and a kids table debate? Which they did in the first at least couple of debates.
Yep, there was.
2016, and nobody was happy with that. So, you know, if they have one debate, I think it doesn't really matter that much. So,
do you expect a double, which is, I'm just guessing. I have no reporting. I have no access.
What do you mean a double? You mean two debates?
You have 40 to 80,000, 1% to 2%, and then third debate be a 160,000 and 4%. That, to me, makes sense. Either you got momentum or you don't.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, with the first debate, does Trump take part? I have to say, as far as debates are concerned, I mean, so many of them are so forgettable. I remember the first debate of the whatever year that was that Herman Cain ran. we're in Greenville, South Carolina, have this debate. And the big question leading into the debate was, can Tim Pawlenty rise into the first tier?
I mean, it was, yeah.
You know, that's,
I remember debates quite specifically, Byron, because I remember that's when President Trump thought I might improve the ratings for my radio show. That's what I recall from that debate.
No, this was a Romney. This is because Romney
2012 debate is with Herman.
He
Cain,
was the front runner. He was the front runner, and he was not there. And my memory of it is, I had no idea. I'd paid no attention at all to Herman Cain. So there was a Frank Luntz focus group afterwards. And I can't remember who I thought won the debate, but it certainly wasn't Herman Cain. But all the people said it was Herman Cain. And I said, wow, I am missing something. So the next day, actually, I went down to Atlanta and spent a few hours with Herman Cain. He was a very interesting guy. And I thought to myself, you know, I totally missed this. I did not understand what people were seeing. People were seeing something different than I'm seeing. So that's always a possibility in the debate.
You have to
remember how forgettable the early ones often are.
I do not care about any polling until after the first debate, because that's where America sits down, watches, and begins to sort through their opinions. So, Byron, I just want to close by this. It's D-Day, right? It's the 79th anniversary of D-Day. Joe Biden was alive for D-Day. Donald Trump wasn't. Do you think that's a way to kind of – I'm bringing up the age issue – Joe Biden was alive for D-Day. I just think it's crazy for him to run for re-election. Do you think that view is gaining momentum among Democrats?
Yeah, it is. Of course it is. And, in the fall the other day, certainly reinforced that. By the way, it wasn't so much the fall, because there really was a sad bag sitting there. It was the fact that he had a hard time getting up.
Yep.
Had to be basically lifted up. And, you know, who knows what would have happened if nobody had been standing around him. They're very concerned. Even the New York Times did an article about this. They couldn't bring themselves to say, well, Biden is too old to be president, and then they spent a lot of time on Trump. But they did report that a lot of Democrats are very worried about this, and that's all they talk about. So, it's going to continue to be an issue, and things like this fall, which is an incident that just reminds people of how old the president is, they're going to keep happening.
Well, I'm telling you, if you got a president who was alive for D-Day, he's pretty old. It'll be our last president who was alive for D-Day, Byron.
Well, you could also just say born in the 1940s, and that would include Trump as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see Joe Biden go to D-Day next year, because it's the 80th anniversary next year. So they'll do the big Normandy thing that Ronald Reagan invented 40 years ago when Joe Biden was in the Senate. Byron York, always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter. Follow me in the next segment, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show on a Tuesday morning. It's D-Day. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt in Studio North, joined by Congressman Ken Calvert. Ken Calvert is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Defense Appropriations of the House Committee on Appropriations, and a longtime friend. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm doing great. Thanks for having
now,
me.
Now, a lot of hawks, and you are a hawk, were unhappy with the debt deal because it only raised defense spending 3%. The necessary changes have to come out of your subcommittee in light of the shortfall in funding that is a consequence of the deal. How are you going to go about that, Mr. Chairman?
Well, first, people have to realize that if we're going to change the long-term future, we need to elect more Republicans, and that includes getting the White House back and the U.S. Senate. But saying that, in the meantime, we've got to make some choices and priorities to fund our national security. And that's what we're going to do. We've been given a number. We're going to be marking to that number. Obviously, it's not enough to meet all the challenges that we have, especially with China, a rising China, especially their shipbuilding program and the inadequacy of our own shipbuilding program. And obviously, we have this issue with Ukraine, we've got issues in North Korea, issues in Iran, and so forth. So we need to find some savings to make that up in this defense appropriation bill, and I'll do that as much as I can. But it's going to be a very tight bill.
Now, Mr. Chairman, one of the things, there are 700,000 people working for the Department of Defense who are not in uniform. I believe that number is correct, 700,000. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is it about time to slim down the civilian employment force of the DOD?
Yes, and I've been focused on that today's civilian workforce is not in, really in a position to implement our national defense strategy. There's too much manual processing, too few with STEM and emerging tech skills. The cost of personnel is rising faster than our total defense spending. The civilian workforce continues to grow as we can't meet our recruiting targets for the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the rest of the military. And we're operating antiquated systems, manual processes that the DOD can't even pass an audit. In short, this path we're on is unsustainable. We have to change it immediately.
So, Chairman Calvert, there was a BRAC a long time ago, Base Realignment and Closure Commission, and the BRAC took it out of Congress's hand, and they cut down a bunch of bases. Do we need a BRAC for civilian employees in the Pentagon, and do we need a BRAC for weapon systems to get the politics out of it and just get down to the bone? Because we got to free up the money for the ships that we need and the submarines that we need and the munitions that we've depleted. We got to get the money, and the best place to get it, in my view, is by closing obsolete weapon systems down and by skinnying the Pentagon down. Do we need a BRAC to do that, or can your committee do it?
Well, we can do a lot of that through the appropriations process. A lot of these legacy systems need to be retired. Just don't fund them. You know, there's a constituency, it seems, around every legacy system, but we're going to have to make these tough decisions to retire some of these aircraft, some of the other systems that are no longer necessary before we can put money into modern warfare. Every dollar we spend needs to go to lethality and for the make sure that our troops are well taken care of. Anything else is superfluous, and we need to focus on what's important, and that starts immediately because we don't have the money to do anything else.
Well, then I get back to contracting as well. I don't think our Department of Defense can contract for weapon systems anymore. I mean, they get some done right. I like the frigate coming out of Wisconsin, and I think they're building good ships in Mississippi, and our submarines are first class. But what about the F-35 delays? What about the LCS? When do we clean this stuff up?
Well, you know, in the 90s, as you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, we went down from a lot of contractors down to a few. We're down to six or seven major defense contractors. There's not enough competition within the system. I think the prices are too high. That's because of that, a lot of it. And so we're trying to bring in new innovation and smaller folks that can make things that we need and are better at it, more efficient at it. And the systems that we're buying are more effective and cost a lot less money. You know, we all love the larger contractors, but they're, you know, it's just too cumbersome.
Could we also empower the SecDef or the Deputy Secretary of Defense to simply skinny the workforce? Because I know I ran OPM when I was back in the Reagan years, and you were starting out in your political career, and you can't fire anyone in the federal government. It's impossible. And reductions in force are impossible. Can you give them sweeping powers to shrink?
Yeah, you know, look, there's one thing we can do, and we can start this right away. The federal government has about a 5% turnover rate, and we don't have to hire 5%. If we just hired 3% and you had a reduction in the civilian workforce of 2% per year, you would get a 10% reduction in the civilian workforce in a matter of short order. But you can do it quicker because we have a lot of folks over there that are up for retirement. We can do some buyouts, removing some of the senior managers God love them, but we need to clean out the ranks. There's lots of ways that we can do to facilitate workforce optimization. And yeah, you know, you were seeing the private sector do it now, and we're going to have to do it also.
I'm not for cleaving people. We just got to get smaller and faster and more nimble and more effective. Congressman, can you walk us through the timing? Because I know part of the debt deal was 12 appropriations bills on the president's desk by January 1. You are the key subcommittee in that process. You are the guy who defends the defense budget of the United States in the House. What is your metric for being on time?
Well, we'll be doing our subcommittee, Mark. We pretty much have the bill written. I went through the bill, had to do the necessary modifications in order to meet the president's budget number. So we're prepared to get the subcommittee here in the next week or so. That schedule is determined by the leadership. Once we have the subcommittee, Mark, we will go to the floor or I mean, go to the full committee probably again sometime here in the month of June. And I anticipate to have the bill on the floor in late June, early July.
Well, that's
so
very
that's
good.
That's a big part of it. Yeah.
That's very good.
I'm not, yeah.
But now tell me about the lobbying process, Congressman, that goes into it. Do you walk down the street and attract 8 defense lobbyists? Are you like, do they have a mobile device attached to your coat?
Yeah, they're a little they're concerned right now because we had to, based upon, you know, we were looking at an increase, a minimum of 3-5% based upon the Mattis National Defense Strategy. And so I had to get to the PV, I had to cut $17 billion out of the defense budget in order to meet that goal. So, yeah, there's going to be some unhappy people. They're all trying to, you know, get their 2 cents in, but we don't have 2 cents.
Your poor staff, it must be like you're under siege in there because you got everybody who sells anything to the Pentagon wants to see Ken Calvert and his team, but you're indifferent to that. You've been doing, how long have you been the ranking or the chair of the Subcommittee on Defense Appropriations, Ken Calvert?
I've been ranking chair for coming into 4 years now.
All right. So you know what you're doing and you know what we're doing. So now I'm going to ask you the tough question. I mean, this is the hardest question. Isn't it time to downsize the Army? Because our new peer competitor is China, and the problem there is the Navy, underwater, cyber, and intel?
Well, the Army's doing a good job of downsizing by not just meeting their recruiting goals. They just got a message yesterday. They're 8,500 short.
Ooh.
So the Navy is short. The Air Force is short. So that's happening. And, yeah, we need to evaluate the force. You know, what's necessary in the next number of years to take on a rising China. I think the Navy is obviously needs the resources to build more ships. We're down to 290 ships. The Chinese will be up 400 ships probably by the end of this decade.
Now, is there any talk about, we've had the triad forever, and I always bring this up. Maybe we don't need as many land-based missiles anymore. Maybe we don't because our underwater deterrent is a survivable one. Anyone talk about big changes?
Oh, people talk about it. But when you go through the war games on it and you evaluate it, you don't want any feeling that any kind of a nuclear conflict is successful against the United States. And a triad, which was obviously developed in the Eisenhower time frame, is pretty foolproof. I mean, if anybody attacks the United States, it's not going to work. So going to a dyad could be risky. So right now we're moving toward continuing to have the triad. As you know, we're going to the Columbia submarine to replace the Ohio-class submarine. We'll still have our attack submarines. And obviously with our new B-21 bomber, which will have penetration capability, we should be able to have a very good nuclear force to make sure that no one ever even thinks about.
Well, let's talk about those land-based missiles. I know the Chinese balloon went up to scope them out because they're worried about them. But when we develop hypersonics, and I'm looking for a two-part answer here, do hypersonics replace the land-based giant missiles? And how are we doing on the hypersonic front, which is, to me, the next 50 years of warfare?
Well, there are two different types of systems. The land-based systems obviously have MIRV capability, have multiple nuclear weapons that you can put on each missile to give you, you know, significant capability. We are not doing very well in the hypersonic program. It's frustrating. We created the technology back in the 90s. The Chinese stole it, perfected it, deployed it. They have over 1,000 hypersonic missiles now deployed. We have none. The Air Force Aero program has just been canceled, unfortunately, because they just can't meet the testing criteria. The Army program, they claim is going to be, they're going to have some deployed by the end of this year. I'm a little cynical about that. And the Navy missile is the same one, and so that's being held back. So I'm trying to kick these guys in the rear and get them moving. We have to get a hypersonic missile deployed here immediately. And, of course, you know, we got budget restraints now and, you know, R&D dollars and so forth, but that's a priority, and we're going to spend money on that to make sure it happens.
Number one priority, and let's close here, Congressman Calvert, is the Columbia class. You mentioned that. You get it. It is the most defensible thing. Are we going to get them in the water on time? I got less than a minute, Congressman.
Yeah, we're in pretty good shape on Columbia. There's a couple lead items that we need to focus on, but we're that's on top of our funding priority list to make sure that we keep Columbia on time. There's a little workforce issues in the shipyards problem we've got. We have a lack of shipyards in America, but we're focused on making sure that Columbia is delivered on time.
Ken Calvert, it is always great to talk to you. Thank you for continuing to steward the nation's defense budget. Have a good markup, and boy, you're moving at the speed of Congress, which is better than ever, and I'm glad to hear it. Thank you, Ken Calvert. I'm coming right back. America, don't go anywhere. Bethany Mandel is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by our friend Bethany Mandel for our Tuesday morning get-together. Good morning, Bethany. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. What is Write Books for Kids? I just tweeted it out, but I don't know much about it. Fill us in.
Thank you for the tweet. So I just launched a new Substack with a girlfriend of mine, and we're sort of reflecting on the success of Stolen Youth, the book that I wrote with Carol Markowitz. People kept on asking for, like, what do I do? What are solutions? And so another homeschool mom and I, Rachel Reeves, decided, like, we have to come up with a solution. And so we've been running an Instagram account for the last year, Write Books for Kids, and it's the number 4, and just sort of sharing, both exposing what is wrong in children's literature now with wokeness, but also like sharing this is what we're reading instead. And so we decided to turn that into a Substack, and we'll be doing author discussions and book clubs and book lists and blogging about, you know, everything that's crazy in children's literature. And now that it's the month of June, we have lots and lots of material.
Yeah, you know, my wife, the fetching Mrs. Hewitt, brought back from a thrift shop yesterday a bundle of books for the grandkids for when they visit in the summer. And they're all classics, right? You don't really need to be pushing out new children's books because there are lots of great children's books in there in thrift shops everywhere. Do you have like a recommended reading list for young parents of what to get age appropriate?
Yeah. We're building those lists. And those lists also exist, you know, all over the place. And you're exactly right that the classics are really where to go. We're working our way through Mark Twain right now. We just finished Tom Sawyer, and we're a couple chapters into Huck Finn. And, you know, it's incredible what kids can read if you just give them the opportunity. My youngest that we're reading Huck Finn with is 6 years old. Like, does he get everything? No, but he gets an awful lot. And he is rightly terrified of the end of Tom Sawyer, as was I. So, you know, sharing.
You're far more advanced than me. My daughter grew up on the Babysitter's Club, and I'm thinking about buying the Bronc Burnett and Rick Brandt series. I hated Tom Swift for The Flash because he loves all sports. Do you know that they used to turn these things out, like 500 of them? They were all over my house. My brothers read Tom Swift. I read Bronc Burnett. Are there any series like that anymore that are just kind of charming and harmless, but reading?
Not really. Not that you can sort of mass produce. There's a Treasure Hunter series that's really sweet. That they like sort of travel all over the world. I have that on our Instagram account. I can't remember the name of it. But you can buy the Hardy Boys and you can buy Babysitter's Club. Now Costco has amazing book selections, surprisingly. But it was funny. Yesterday, my 9-year-old was a mother's helper and she told me that she used some of the tricks that she read in the Babysitter's Club with the little girls that she was watching. So it's all still
applicable. We still have a complete collection of the Babysitter's Club, but, they've blown past it. We have to wait for their Genghis Kate to show up. Bethany, tell me a little bit about the Substack, because what else do you do? How often do you write it? How do people subscribe to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's writebooks4kids.substack.com. And we're blogging, you know, 5 times a week, and a combination of blog posts and what else? Book lists. We're going to be doing a podcast this summer. Your producer was just helping me out with trying to figure out how to launch that.
Because don't listen
to
him.
I'm not an audio person.
Don't listen to him.
Oh, no.
That's a false flag right there. But I am so happy about this because a lot of parents don't even know where to go. So what are you just offering? Yes. An alternative, positive? Here's how you go with a traditional style of education for your child that is not politicized. Is that the basic delivery system?
Yeah. Yeah. We're basically want to be the conservative resource for parents who want to see like the latest craziness, but also what to be reading with their kids instead and what to be doing with their kids instead. And we're also going to be sharing, because we're both homeschool moms, we'll be sharing sort of, this is the curriculum that we're using. These are the new books that we got, because there's just an overwhelming amount of options out there for homeschool parents. And so we sort of want to.
So Bethany, I got a minute. I just want to ask you to capture for me. I look at Twitter and I see libs for TikTok, and I think this cannot be this widespread. It's got to be a small. How big is the problem of politicized teachers politicizing kids?
It's really crazy. I mean, every single day here in Montgomery County, Maryland, I'm seeing there's a Twitter account, LGBT for MOCO, like MCPS, the school system, and they're posting pictures. They're proud of it. They're posting pictures of like, these are all the pride activities we're doing with our students. They're posting their full names, their full face pictures. And these are teachers who are really proud of the activities that they're doing. And parents have to email the superintendents and the principals to be like, hi, this is not appropriate. And they'll delete one picture and one tweet. Meanwhile, their entire Twitter feed is pictures of kids doing pride activities, fully identifiable. They think that the kids belong to them and they can do whatever they want.
I can't believe anyone puts a kid's picture on the internet without the consent of the parent. That's just like a no-go that Mary Catherine Hamm taught me. And I know you thought you do not publish pictures of identifiable children on the internet. You just don't do it.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
It's,
Montgomery County Schools?
It's against policy. Yeah. One of my friends emailed the principal yesterday and said, hi, one of your teachers has all of these students' pictures and names on her Twitter account. And the principal responded and said, oh, I had her delete that tweet. And my friend said, go back to her Twitter account. She has more pictures.
Unbelievable. Bethany, keep coming back. Follow her on Twitter at Bethany Shondark. Go to writebooks4kids.substack.com and subscribe. I'm coming right back. America, Molly Hemingway is next on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hugh Hewitt, starting off with the editor-in-chief at The Federalist, Molly Hemingway, also a Fox News contributor. Good morning, Molly. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm terrific. It's D-Day. Joe Biden was alive on D-Day. Do you think he'll be the last president in American history who was alive on D-Day?
Probably, but I don't know. The strength of these boomers is strong. So
he's not a boomer, Molly. He's too old to be a boomer.
Oh, is he? I guess that's right, because the whole point would be that boomers came after that. I think, That's amazing,
we're done.
Actually, so.
There's no one else. That just tells me how old the guy is. Secondly, I have three things to talk about with you. That's just marking Joe Biden's age, because I don't think that should ever be far from people's mind. I think he's manifestly infirm now, Molly. What do you think?
I don't think it's the age. I think it's where you are in life, because there are people who are younger than he is who are doing worse. There are people who are older than he is who are doing fine. But the man clearly hasn't just lost a step. He's lost many steps. And it's not even the physical falls. It's the mental acuity that I think is disconcerting. And just, you know, our press can kind of cover it up, but the international community can see that he is feeble and not really up to the job. So it just adds to problems that we have.
I want people to think about, if those ships had collided in the Taiwan Strait, who would have made the decision on response? You would have had Pacific Commander talking to the National Security Council, but I just can't imagine the president running that crisis, Molly.
I don't actually think that the current president is running anything, though. It's one of the things that makes life a little difficult is you don't actually know who's making the decisions. President Biden is frequently undercut by his staff. He'll say things and he'll then walk it back a little bit later. He seems confused about what's going on. I would like to know who's making the decision, even as it's pretty clear that Democrats are very unified on their policies. They might not be the policies that a lot of Americans like, but you don't see a lot of disagreement with Joe Biden and the Hill and anyone in his anyone in the upper echelons of the Democrat Party. But still, I'd like to know who's running.
I don't think he's going to be their nominee. I just don't. I think there'll be an LBJ exit like 1968. Do you think he's going to be their nominee?
Okay, first off, I don't think any of us really thought that he would be their nominee. I mean,
right. I didn't.
But what are they going to do? I mean, they can't have it be Kamala. She's one of the few people who has lower approval ratings than he does. She's one of the few people who has more verbal stumbles than he does. And so how do they get him to have a polite exit without having it seem like they have to nominate her? And then that's not going to go well. So I almost think he will be the nominee.
A late exit followed by an entry of Gavin Newsom. Write it down. All right, Molly, let's go to two things in the news. Christopher Wray. A lot of my friends know and like Christopher Wray. I don't know the director. There is no reason under the sun that the FBI can deny the Oversight Committee a document. There is no, people write to me, oh, there's lots of reasons not to give the document over. Constitutionally, there is none. It is a complete abridgment of the authority of the Congress to conduct oversight. Is there any consequence for what is an abuse of power by Director Wray?
So you're absolutely right that constitutionally there's that this is how it's done, and our overseers have the right to look into this, particularly given the reasons why they're looking into this. But it's also true that the FBI has lost all credibility when it comes to these kinds of document disputes. So during the Russia collusion hoax, you had Devin Nunes and other Republicans asking to see information because they were trying to figure out whether there really was Russia collusion or whether the FBI had acted improperly. The FBI would deny that documents existed. Then they would say that you could only see them under limited scenarios. Or they would say, if we let you see this, it would hurt national security. Turned out that if they had let them see it, it would have hurt the FBI because it was embarrassing to the FBI. They're doing the exact same thing with this document, which is about, you know, whether the FBI improperly closed a legitimate inquiry with a legitimate source. There, I mean, Congress has every right, and Grassley and Comer are doing a very good job of pushing that, but they shouldn't be facing the resistance they're facing from Wray.
And the nonsense I see on the media, if Molly Hemingway or Hugh Hewitt gets a subpoena today, we don't get to say, we think it's disadvantageous to our security to turn that over to you. We don't get to say no. Everyone's got to show up at the grand jury. Everyone's got to answer a subpoena. And when Congress, otherwise, if people just follow it through, Molly, if you can turn down the request for a document on one grounds, you can turn down the request for all documents. All documents. And the FBI went to Mar-a-Lago, broke in and took the documents they wanted, but they won't turn over a document. I just don't understand why there isn't an uproar.
Particularly when the FBI has now a multi-year history of running investigations in a way that privileges political allies, such as how they were very gentle with the Hillary Clinton investigations. And it is investigations, not just one, as we learned from the recent Durham report, and then how they just run roughshod over political enemies. And this dispute, again, relates to legitimate whistleblowers saying that there were legitimate inquiries, you know, inquiries that weren't brought to their natural conclusion, but were politically closed. The idea that we are going to trust the FBI after years of them destroying their own reputation is laughable. But I do think there's outcry among average Americans. I think you're seeing the media try to cover for their friends.
I agree. I don't care if it's a crayon drawing by Christopher Wray's kids. They have to turn it over if Congress wants an Article I agency or Bureau's document. Molly, I want to turn to the leaks coming out of the Department of Justice. Like almost every day, there's a new leak on the Trump special counsel. I view this as indirect lobbying of the attorney general to go ahead and greenlight the indictment. He has to sign off on a special counsel indictment. There's no way around that. Rod Rosenstein wrote that last year in the Wall Street Journal. It's absolutely clear. Do you think that's what they're doing, piling up pressure via selective leaks? Now, CBS spotted the Trump lawyers, but so many leaks have come out of justice. This is just Jack Smith piling on Merrick Garland to go ahead with what will be a destabilizing indictment.
And again, this is after years of leaks from the FBI designed for political purposes. It's not just pushing for an indictment, even though, I mean, what we have to look at is this entire widespread effort by the Democrat Party to indict top political opponents, like we are the Soviet Union or like we're under Putin right now. We in this country, we're not supposed to use the legal process to go after political opponents. I get that Donald Trump is a formidable opponent to Democrats. That does not mean they should be using the legal system or the Department of Justice, and that's all that's been happening for the last 6 or 7 years. The bigger problem, I think, for the Department of Justice is no one views them as credible. You saw that recent poll coming out showing that a majority of Americans think either that the FBI should be radically reworked or completely destroyed and built from the ground up because of the corruption that's inherent in that in those agencies. And so you need to deal with that. The idea that you could indict someone for doing something that we all kind of know now other people have done. I mean, and Joe Biden has document problems going back to when he was a senator which there's no excuse for, and then they're going to try to go after Trump, probably, you know, according to these leaks to their friendly allies at the Washington Post, for obstruction issues, just like they did with the Russia collusion hoax. It's not going to work with the American people.
But it will have an impact on politics. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I do see what's going on here, and I think the prosecutors are trying to pressure Garland into it, because prosecutors want to prosecute. You're Jack Smith. This is your day in the sun. This is the only thing you'll ever do that anyone will notice. So you want to indict Donald Trump, and so does your team, just like Robert Mueller's team wanted to indict Trump, and there wasn't anything there. But I am curious what you think the consequences politically will be of an indictment. The Alvin Bragg effect is wearing off. Ron DeSantis is closing the gap with Donald Trump, and maybe the rest of the field as well. Two new polls today show that, because Trump got a bump from Alvin Bragg. I think he'll get like 25 points if the Department of Justice indicts him. Do you think, I don't, but do you think that might be a motive for some people?
I think the motive is they think it will politically harm eventually President Trump. They might even find the idea that it would harm him after helping him get the nomination to be a secondary bonus. It's hard to know, because so much of the dispute in Republican politics right now is who understands the threat of these federal agencies that are acting in an improper manner, who's willing to take them on. This is why both Trump and DeSantis are doing well, relatively speaking, because they are the two candidates who really seem to get that we have major problems with the politicized law enforcement, that they're coming after not just people like Trump, but pro-life activists and everybody in between. So it'll continue to be a salient issue.
Last question, Molly. Reconciliation. If the Republicans swept it and they get a reconciliation 50-point, would you use your reconciliation to reform the federal government? In other words, destroy the ironclad protections that federal civil servants have against being fired and bring some accountability to the federal government?
Reform of civil service is one of the most important things for returning the country to its constitutional understanding. Right now, our bureaucracy is acting as a fourth branch of government. It is a threat to the American project, to our civil liberties. So anything that can be done would be good.
Amen. And reconciliation, people want to do other things. Remember, if you change the size and scope of the federal government, make the federal workforce accountable, you've changed the government forever. Molly Hemingway, follow her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway, see her on Fox News and read her at The Federalist. Thank you. Molly, coming right back, America. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Look at this book, The Puppeteers. You cannot forget the title of The Puppeteers. And we will say it seven times. It's by Jason Chaffetz, who's now with Fox News. And Jason, of course, used to chair the House Oversight Committee. And Jason is taller than you think. That's the first thing I realized when Jason walked in the green room and told me he had a new book out. Jason Chaffetz, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good to have you. How tall are you, Jason?
I'm 7'7".
I mean, thought so.
I'm sorry, I meant 6'2". That's what I meant to say. Pardon me.
Well, you're very tall. And I love The Puppeteers. I have 13 things to ask you in 13 minutes. We're going to move fast. The puppeteers, the people who control the people who control America, is very depressing stuff. It seems like an endless list in this book of absurd attacks on the central assumptions of American life. At the end of writing The Puppeteers, are you as depressed as I was at the end of reading it?
Yeah, no, it scared me. It scared me because I didn't realize the depth of the problem, that it was trillions upon trillions of dollars. And it's not something you can just flip the switch and fix. But if you do, well, I feel like we're fighting all the wrong fights. We don't. This is where the fight is, and it's where these leftists have been for a long time.
You know, Jason, you've got to say the title, The Puppeteers, in every answer. If you want people, it's the Luntz rule. If you don't say The Puppeteers seven times, no one will. So you say, yeah, The Puppeteers depressed me. I'm honest to goodness, I'm always coaching. Number two, I want to start with January Littlejohn and her 13-year-old in Leon County Schools. I cannot believe that story. Do you want to tell people about it?
Well, the problem is that you have schools that have been manipulated to the point where they cannot, these puppeteers, they believe in what are a new term that we're going to have to get used to called community schools. And the idea of community schools is that they take care of your child from top to bottom, everything from what haircut they get to what they wear to what the meals they have. And so when somebody wants to maybe push this child to go get a gender, change their gender, these people were not even informed. The parents didn't even know what was going on.
And they were
on.
Sympathetic parents. They wanted to help their daughter who was undergoing gender confusion, but they were worried about it being contagion because three of her friends had done this thing. And so they tell her teacher, be aware, and they're willing to go wrong with a name change. And then the parents suck her. I mean, the school sucks her into a different track. It's unbelievable.
No, and again, I think it's a bigger concerted effort. It's not just an isolated case that we highlight here. There is this move for these community schools to take your child and essentially run their entire lives, not just educate them on math, reading, and arithmetic. That's why I wrote The Puppeteers.
There you go. Bingo. Okay. Now that brings me to Randy Weingarten in The Puppeteers, because she may be the biggest puppeteer of all. You lay out her role in keeping the schools closed. We are on a vast re-education campaign right now to erase that. The Puppeteers is stopping that. Do you think she will succeed in preventing the public from remembering who got the schools closed and who kept them closed?
That's up to us. That's why you write a book like The Puppeteers, is because you want to make sure it's documented. Look, she has some $300 million at her disposal. We talk about there's some good work with Peter Schweitzer's group, the Government Accountability Institute, good research about how they've morphed and changed into a political operation, not something that's just out there helping their teachers. But they are trying to rewrite history. And we also tell some interesting stories about her ties to Hunter Biden and how some of the cronies from Rosemont, Seneca, or one of the offshoots of that, went out and, you know, the teachers' unions were spent $3 million getting these personal protective equipment out of China that ended up being, well, fake and bogus. But again, you can see how incestuous it is over there.
Now, I will come back to the PatCon chapter in The Puppeteers. I do want to talk about the FBI and parents. Now, Christopher Wray, this is not in The Puppeteers, but you're here. Christopher Wray has refused to turn over a document. You were in Jim Comer's position, right? There's a picture of Jim Comer. You know what a subpoena is. Does he have any leg to stand on in turning down the subpoena that he's been given for documents?
No, it's an unclassified document, a duly issued subpoena that should be an open and shut case. The problem is, and Trey Gowdy and I would talk about this a lot, is your ability to enforce a subpoena. That's the strength of your subpoena. How good can you enforce it? And the problem is you have to then go to the Department of Justice to enforce a subpoena on the Department of Justice. So until Congress figures out how to fight for itself and stand up as a co-equal branch of government, guess what? Not going to happen.
Well, they now need to hold Chris Wray in contempt, which is unfortunate. I've only heard good things about him, but this is unacceptable from a constitutional point of view. Jason Chaffetz, in The Puppeteers, you write about PatCon. And I know a little bit about the FBI and a little bit about the Church Committee. I know a little bit about all this different stuff. But I didn't realize that you believe they egged on the white supremacists in the Whitmer case. I didn't know that. Are you sure about that? Because I've never been persuaded that the FBI egged on the people who were going to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer.
No, I don't say that in the book. In The Puppeteers, I highlight this case. What's interesting to me about this is that usually if you go to a federal judge in Washington, D.C., they're pretty sympathetic to the D.C. machine. But Judge Wadups in Utah is just reading the law, and this case is still open, and it's a FOIA case. It's a Freedom of Information case. Do these people have the right to have this information? So you have this judge in Utah who believes that it should. I'm not trying to come to any conclusions whatsoever, but I think it's interesting that is our government going to be open and transparent? We're different in the world in that we are open and transparent. We are self-critical. But what's interesting and fascinating about this case is, where are the documents? Did this actually happen? Did it not happen? I don't come to any conclusions. I'm just saying we need the documentation.
Well, let's move on to something where you do have a conclusion. I agree with it. Secretary Mayorkas is a fiasco and a disaster. When you finished writing this book, you had fiscal year 2022, 3 million illegal entries in the United States. Fiscal year 2023 is going to be 4 million, Jason Chaffetz. And yet they're focused on white supremacy. I had Secretary Clinton on this show. Secretary Clinton said, at most, we have 600,000 white supremacists in the United States, and they're not all violent. They're all kind of nuts, but they're not all violent. The question is, why is he fixated on that and not on 4 million people about whom we know nothing entering into the United States?
There's a theme that kind of a thread that runs through the Puppeteers book, and that they need white supremacy in order to justify many of the things they would never be able to get and do as a power stroke in the federal government and through these non-government organizations and all of these slush funds that they create. I think one thing that's stunning about the book is we highlight by the hundreds of billions of dollars the slush funds that are at the disposal of the Democratic machine. So no matter who goes into office, no matter who gets elected, the bureaucratic machine continues on, and they have so much money. If you don't starve the beast, you don't solve the problem. And you start to see this thread here, and they have to have white supremacy out there in order to justify, hey, we've got to fight that at every level, every organization, everything. No doubt there's some white supremacy out there, but is it the number one thing facing our country right now? I don't think so.
No, I don't either. And I think you make that argument very good. You also make a lot of arguments in The Puppeteers about the ESG madness that we've entered into.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for state treasurers. You know, when Doug Ducey was state treasurer of Arizona, he wouldn't put up with this nonsense. They are costing billions and billions of dollars to people who depend on those pensions. And I just read about the Illinois state pension system and news items by John Ellis this weekend. They're already bankrupt, right? They're effectively bankrupt, and they're still wasting money on ESG, Jason Chaffetz. Thanks for that chapter in The Puppeteers.
Yeah, so in The Puppeteers, we highlight the idea that BlackRock, for instance, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street or Main Street, they control 75%+ of the retirement funds and whatnot. If you look at the S&P 500, BlackRock alone, I think it's north of 97% of the S&P companies, BlackRock owns at least a 5% stake. And so you wonder, why are all of these companies pursuing ESG and DEI and all of these types of things? It's because BlackRock has an agenda. I mean, Larry Fink was just out there, you can find it on Twitter pretty easily, talking about how you have to manipulate these companies because they won't do it by themselves. These are the types of puppeteers. You know, in the Trump administration, Larry Kudlow was the economic advisor, right? And what happened when Joe Biden came in on board? They brought in Brian Deese. Brian Deese worked in the Obama administration, but he's a climate activist. That's his background. And he's the economic advisor for Joe Biden. He left recently, but this is their agenda. This is what they want to do. It's not about improving the economy or bringing up real wages. It's about getting these requirements into these companies, in the government, and everywhere. Those are the true puppeteers.
You know, I like your story about Uncle Joe and Wheezy. I really think that's very illustrative. But the ERISA law, I only did one ERISA case in all of my years. I never want to get near it again. I think you're illustrating to people that their pension funds, wherever they are in danger because the companies are beset by the Larry Finks and the ESG absolutists and this absurd idea of, quote, stakeholder capitalism. The only stakeholder in a publicly traded company is the shareholder. Everybody else is an alien to them. And you make that argument, Jason, is it getting traction? There is no such thing as stakeholder capitalism. There's capitalism, and it's run by investors and people who take risks, not by people on the sidelines.
Well, I can tell you're passionate about this, but the puppeteers I highlight, we got our hands on a document that nobody had seen before. It's put out by the Democrats Association, and what they do is they are selling for $50,000 or $100,000 a seat. Come meet with your state financial officer that's a Democrat or the state treasurer. And then they list out what they control. The Democrats have under their control more than $1 trillion that they use from these investment funds. So if you're a retired teacher, retired employee, a government employee in these states like California, I think it's close to $750 billion that they can invest. Well, they take these proxy votes and go into these companies to manipulate them. So you look at your company and say, hey, why are they doing all this crazy stuff? It's because of the proxy voting that's happening.
It's because of the puppeteers. Jason Chaffetz, last question. If Senator Romney doesn't run for re-election, are you running?
I'm thinking about it. I am thinking about it. I haven't figured out. I don't know. I love what I'm doing.
Come on, just say yes. If he retires, I'm going. Just say yes, Jason.
Oh, look at the time, Hugh. Thanks for the time to talk about the puppeteers.
Jason Chaffetz, congratulations on the puppeteers. Stay tuned, America. Brett Baer is coming next. He's running. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt in Studio North. Brett Baer will be in the moderator chair when the first Republican debate is held in Milwaukee in August. Ronna McDaniel joins me tomorrow on the show. I'm going to ask her to make sure we regulate Brett's tie brightness because it's always very gold. Brett Baer, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. Good morning. I usually go with the red, white, and blue, but we'll see.
Okay. Now, I've been seeing a lot of gold. Hey, I want to talk to you about not that debate, but the forum, the Senate forum you are moderating on Monday at 11 o'clock. I think it's streaming on Fox Nation. Joni Ernst is one of my favorite interviews, and Gene Sheen I've never had on. What are they talking about, and what is the Senate forum, and why are you putting it on Fox Nation?
Yeah, this is the fourth actual Senate project series, and it is an effort by the Bipartisan Policy Center, and this is a collaboration between the Orrin Hatch Foundation and the Edward M. Kennedy Institute to try to foster bipartisan conversation, civil discussion, much like the goal of the U.S. Senate originally was. And this is Gene Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, and Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, focusing mostly this time on foreign policy, but other topics as well, and utilizing, and this is the really cool part, the full-scale replica of the United States Senate chambers. It's in Boston at the Edward M. Kennedy Institute, and it's just a really cool venue. I did the first one between Lindsey Graham and Bernie Sanders, which was a real success. It is streaming on Fox Nation at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and it'll run again on Fox News Channel Sunday at 10 p.m.
That's what I was looking for, because those of us who go to bed after we work the early shift will not be awake at 11 a.m. on Monday. So you are going to rebroadcast the conversation between Senators Ernst and Shaheen?
We are on Fox News Channel the following Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. So it's really an interesting project. It had, as I mentioned, Bernie Sanders and Lindsey Graham. Then there was Chris Murphy and Rob Portman. And now we have Gene Shaheen and Joni Ernst. And the forecast is to have another one in September in Washington.
Okay, I'm going to nudge you towards Jack Reed and Tom Cotton to talk about China and national defense, because, Brett, I want to come to this, and I hope you bring it up with Joni Ernst and Senator Shaheen. The Chinese ran a destroyer across the paths of two of our destroyers, or our destroyer and the Canadian destroyer. That was a close-run thing. I talked to Captain Hendricks about it this morning. Do you think that Joe Biden was on the line monitoring that? Do you think he's in a position to actually respond if the Chinese engage in a shouldering incident at sea?
You know, the Biden administration says so, and Admiral Kirby says so, but it's hard to believe that that he was actively engaged at that moment or in the moments after. I agree with you. I think that was a big provocation added to kind of the close flyby and the other actions we've seen from China recently. And it seems, at least to critics of the administration, that the administration is trying hard to tamp things down, to try to negotiate, to try to reach out to the Chinese. You had the defense secretary, you know, shaking hands with the Chinese defense minister, trying to get a one-on-one that they disregarded, didn't do. Those kind of interactions seem like we are coming from a place of weakness and not strength, at least from, you know, the folks who follow Chinese actions.
Now, Speaker McCarthy said there will be no supplemental for the Defense Department on top of the debt ceiling deal. But I've heard other things, Brett Baer, that coming out of the Senate, we might see a supplemental because 3% is not enough. What do you hear on that regard?
I do think that there's going to be an effort. It'll be fought from the left, but there are some folks in a bipartisan fashion who believe that there should be.
Do you think that'll come up with Gene Shaheen and Joni Ernst? Because, boy, they're both pretty good on defense. It's not surprising. The East Coast senators like Jack Reed and Gene Shaheen and Chris Murphy are pretty good on defense. It's the not Bernie, but Joni Ernst is very good on defense. Is that what the key is in the Senate project?
It'll definitely come up, Hugh, and the future of what our defense posture looks like. We'll get down into the weeds. When you have an hour back and forth. And, you know, it's a different format. It's not like a Q&A. There are statements, there's responses. I then question there. You know, it's much more interactive, which I know you've been fighting for in a format for a debate for a long time.
I believe that's the key. Last question, Brett Baer. Ron is on tomorrow, Chairwoman McDaniel. They put the original bar in, 40,000 individual contributors, 1%. Do you expect that to double for every debate, which is what I'm guessing?
Yeah, I bet it's going to go up a little bit more quickly. I think their wish is to have, you know, fewer people on the stage. It looks like you're going to be able to get one stage initially, which is a big plus. You remember back in 2015, we had yeah. two stages of a lot of people. So I think we're coming to the end this week of people getting in, but we'll see. You know, there can always be a surprise.
Brett Baer, always a pleasure to talk to you. We'll be watching Monday at 11 a.m. for the Senate Project at the Edward Kennedy Library in Boston. Joni Ernst, Gene Shaheen, talking national security and everything else Brett Baer throws at them, and we are grateful for that effort. It will replay on Sunday night at 10 p.m. on the Fox News channel, which is great news as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Jacob. Thank you, everybody in that studio. I think there are like 5,000 people in that studio today, and even Dwayne, who showed up. I appreciate it. I'll be back tomorrow on the next You Do It show.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.